Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
Good morning. Ilona Thompson, Palate Exposure, coming to you from Napa Valley, which is incredibly sunny and gorgeous today. Particularly tempting to be outdoors, by the way, but I am very happy to be indoors with a woman I've been wanting to get to know for a long time, Emma Swain, who's the president and CEO of St. Cyprien Winery, an extraordinary facility that you must get to know at some point. Today, we're going to get to know Emma and her journey, both professional and personal. Thank you for being here.
Well, thanks for coming to visit me. It's great to have you here at St. Cyprien.
Thank you. And you have quite a storied career. So I want to get to know every single bit from the very beginning.
Oh, okay. Yeah, my parents immigrated after having my three brothers in the UK. They went to Boston for business for my dad, and so that's where I ended up being born.
Okay.
And then we moved back a few years later to England, and then came back to the US and have been here, at least living in the U.S. ever since.
Wow. So growing up in the East Coast, did you go to school there as well? Or?
No, we lived in Maine and Massachusetts,
okay.
And then Florida for quite some time. And then in the middle of my junior year in high school, we moved to Saratoga, California, so Bay Area.
Okay.
I mean, the Bay Area, my dad took a job out here, and I finished high school in Mountain View, and then I went to UC Davis.
How did you wind up at UC Davis?
Well,
there's a story there.
This is like a good parental story. So my father said I had a scholarship to a private university in Florida, and I really wanted to move back because I had just moved to California and I missed my friends.
Aww.
And my dad said, "Well, Emma, if you go to Florida, then you won't get any money. And if you live at home and go to UC Santa Clara, then we'll cover everything. And if we go to Davis, we'll pay your rent." I said, "Dad, I'm going to Davis."
Oh,
it was pretty easy solution.
You can't refuse.
Yes, how to guide your children through financial solutions to their college education.
So clearly he had very strong feelings about UC Davis is what it sounds like.
Well, I think, you know, they either wanted me to be at home or be close to home.
Okay.
You know, as I was the youngest of four and the only girl, I think they felt like it would be good for me to be home near them.
Yes.
And I'm very happy I went to UC Davis. I met my husband my freshman year there. And
aww.
So obviously, you know, the education was great,
yes.
But which lasts a lifetime, as does the marriage.
That alone is worth celebrating.
Yeah.
You know, especially these days, to have that kind of a long-term relationship and partnership is very special.
Yeah.
What were you studying at UC Davis?
So I went in pre-med, mm-hmm. and ended up going into ag and managerial economics. So I did study a lot of science, which I really enjoyed, and was working on a minor in biology. And I thought, wouldn't it be great to work and be in the wine business? And then I thought, you know, I'm really kind of tired of being poor. It can't be mm-hmm. possible to have a career in the wine business. Silly mm-hmm. me. And so I had a degree in ag and managerial economics, and I went to go work for a consulting firm in public accounting.
Wow. So you chose a career that, you know, obviously very good at those disciplines and that, you know, aligned with your talents and skills. And how did you wind up, what happened next, I should say, because I'm dying to ask, obviously, how did you wind up in the wine business after all, but we have to work up to this.
We have to work up to that, sorry.
Yes.
So I was working in public accounting, and one of the partners that I worked for, I'd helped him place a couple of people with some clients and friends of mine, and they'd been good placements, and so he said to me one day, Emma, do you know anybody who'd like to go work in the wine business? And I said, well, me. And he said, well, I can't take you because you're important here. And I said, well, actually, I have an offer with Bain Capital right now. And I've always wanted to work in the wine business. And I think it would be a great idea. So he had a client that he pitched me to be still employed by mm-hmm. Arthur Andersen and to go and work for there as their contract CFO.
Wow.
So I did that, contract controller, and I went to work for the Coppolas to help them with the wine business and to help purchase the Inglenook property.
So wow, that's
what we did.
That's quite a momentous occasion right there.
It was great, and I worked for John Skepney at the time, was the mm-hmm. general manager, and Scott McLeod was the winemaker, and Tony Soder, the consulting winemakers, and I learned so much from all of them. It was a great induction into the wine business.
How was it transitioning from, you know, between the two worlds? Wine business is a very unique animal.
Yeah. But, you know, I think what's wonderful about being in public accounting and working for a lot of small businesses, because I was in the small and emerging business section. So you see companies that are growing and growing rapidly. And one of the things you learn is the importance of structure and controls in your business environment so that you can grow effectively.
Mm-hmm.
And if you set up those processes and procedures early on, your business can grow successfully without a lot of hiccups along the way. And I think that's one of the things that I've brought to the businesses that I've worked with in the wine business.
You know, that is such an important point, because I think wine business is perceived largely by the public as either heavily corporate and kind of scary in that sense,
mm-hmm.
or really small moms and pops who are really not necessarily skilled and as aware of the fact that wine business is a wine business,
right.
and need to really focus and pay attention to strategic issues and marketing and things of that nature. I thought what you said was really interesting, that fusion of your experience between the two worlds that typically I viewed as highly separate, but the principles sound very similar. Is that
the principles are very similar? And I worked with a fair amount of agriculture and family businesses and emerging businesses on the public side, and then you know, we grew the Nibom Coppola Estate Winery at the time quite significantly, particularly
yeah.
with the acquisition of the Inglenook property
mm-hmm.
and what we were doing with the vineyards there and growing the brand. So that was pretty cool. And putting in the systems mm-hmm. that you need in order to be able to do that,
mm-hmm.
then you can make the acquisitions and add items on once you have firm processes in place. And then you don't have to think about it again, right?
Yeah.
Well, you kind of do, but but you know, if the processes are in place, then you can grow if you have a good sound structure to start with.
And it's interesting because Coppola always seemed like a family, not just a family wine, but had that feel of something that's, you know, very romantic and very, you know, just kind of like every time you walk in the building, it's a big historical, you know, almost revelatory thing, but also very personable.
Mm-hmm.
So that vibe never went away. But what you did is you put in place something that allowed for the business to flourish.
Right. And that's the goal, by having software programs in place and the ability to plan and cost and know what your products are is really important. So,
yeah.
you know, early in my career, I was very focused on the planning and execution side, and that my background in science helped with
mm-hmm.
Thinking of ways to save money by items that you're using in the winemaking process. So a lot of that sort of moved along smoothly. And from the Coppolas, I went to go work for the Sebastiani family.
Oh,
and
wow.
at the time, we were about the third largest winery in the U.S.
Wow.
And I was with them for 13 years, and we did a lot of system improvements there. And and then we sold the majority of the wineries to Constellation.
Yeah.
So we went from about 8 million cases to 70,000 cases.
Wow.
And we were selling 70,000 cases, and we had about 300,000 cases worth of grape contracts. So it was fun to, you know, go from that, where I was CFO when we were large, to becoming the COO, and then look at how do we rebrand ourselves as a Sonoma-driven winery and be about the Sebastiani brand versus being more of a consumer products organization, which is where you get when you're 8 million cases.
Yes. So that rebranding piece is also exceptionally interesting. How do you take someone that has a reputation and perception, you know, both public and trade, and create a different one?
I think that you have to walk the talk, and that may sound a little cliche, but doing what you say you're going to do and doing it well is very meaningful in our industry, both at the consumer level and at the distributor level, because mm-hmm. our distributors are our partners and we need them to be, and they need to have faith that we're going to do what we say we're going to do. And our customers need to have faith that when they take that next bottle of Chardonnay or Cabernet, and that's the same vintage or a different vintage, that it's going to be equal or better quality than what they had last time. And so executing on that, I think, is the most important thing that you can do in any wine business. You have to deliver and say what you're going to do and do it. It takes time.
Yes, and that's what I was wondering about. Is it a matter of long-term strategy and really having that vision of what this brand should look and feel like and then building up to that?
Absolutely. I mean, you have to know where you want to go. And very often I don't say I have a 5-year plan or mm-hmm. 3-year plan, because sometimes that makes people nervous. I just say, what's the vision? What's our long-term vision? And we go to execute on that. And everything we do is focused on that long-term vision. And at St. Supery, that encompassed a number of things when I wrote that out in my first 3 months here with our team. And you know, we ended up reaching those goals in 5 to 6 years, and everyone thought they're still far up there. So I said, okay, so now we'll go back to our little vision pyramid and we're gonna make it a little more challenging. But we don't necessarily put a hard date on it, but we look at it at least a couple times a year and say, how are we doing to mm-hmm. execute against those long-term goals? Mm-hmm. And our strategic plan and our business plan, you know, follow that.
And it's applicable to any size business, isn't it?
Absolutely.
You know,
you need to know where you're going, and you need to have measurements to ensure that you're going to get there. Otherwise, you know, what's the point?
Yeah. No, I love it. So, St. Supery, I had a very fortuitous and almost serendipitous opportunity to sit down with Michele Rodano, your predecessor.
Yeah.
It just aligned. And she, of course, spoke very highly of you. I mean, I know you were interviewed by the board of directors, but she was very much your champion and handpicked
she's great.
You. So she can say enough good things about that choice.
Well, and that's mutual.
Yeah, so it is truly an honor to sit down with such two extraordinary, you know, I wanted to say women, but really, leaders and executives in the true sense of the word, because what she started and created, and while you picked up the baton and took it further, there's the common thread of a brand that's exceptionally special, not just because it's a winery in Napa Valley, but had that vision and had that dedication to quality. But it had to have been, you know, in some ways big shoes to fill, even though you've had, you know, like I said, great professional achievements. But how was it when you were first hired?
You know, it was interesting for me because it was also the first time I didn't have family nearby as far as family of the winery. The family ownership was all living in France. And so a lot of the hospitality side would fall to me, whereas at Sebastiani, I could always say to Richard and Mary Ancunio, hey, can you host these people and so mm-hmm. forth? Because obviously hospitality is a big part of what we do. Mm-hmm. And at Sebastiani, they love to do that, and it's always fabulous to have the family members there. So that was kind of my handoff. So for me, it was more of a lifestyle balance too, because you know, I'm very focused on achieving my goals and had been managing the international markets and sales and so forth. But the hospitality component at the winery in the evenings and stuff was a bigger time investment than I expected. Of course, very rewarding, but that was actually probably the most dramatic change for me.
So being the face of the brand, really, yeah, greeting guests.
Yeah, and I mean, I always did somewhat because I had my own customers around the country, mm-hmm. and to a certain degree, but not always.
Yes.
Right. So that was a change. And, you know, I meet nice people all over the world, and I meet nice people here all the time, so it's really not a burden. But it was a, you know, different for me to say, oh, I really need to think about my schedule, because yeah. so much of the wine business crosses personal and private and business.
Yes, absolutely. So, time management, isn't that the peril for all of us? How did you harness that? I want to know just personally. I know. Learning a lot already, but I need to know this for my own purpose.
My husband might say I haven't. I like to think that, you know, I've got it under control, but you know, I try to be very organized and have, you know, routines in order to, you know, make sure that I achieve a lot of my personal goals as well.
Absolutely. It's just such a social business that if you let that, you know, happen organically, I think there's no end to it, especially if someone as engaging as you are, as an interesting of a person.
Well, that's pretty sweet.
So you have been with the brand now for a decade, I understand, right?
Yeah.
You came here in 2009. How has things changed, and what happened in that last 10 years?
Wow, there's been a huge amount of change. So 2 weeks after I started, our winemaker resigned. Nothing to do with me, but he had a fantastic offer, and yeah. He left. And so it was great. From the perspective of, I thought I had certain priorities, and then I realized, actually, this is my number one priority, and sort of reset what I needed to focus on. But it also gave me an opportunity to dive very deeply into the vineyards and into the winery and the winery infrastructure. And we interviewed a lot of cult winemakers and amazing people who gave me and our VP of vineyard operations at the time a lot of feedback about what they thought about our vineyards, what they thought about our facility. Mm-hmm. And I think that feedback was really valuable to get early on, especially from such a diverse group of people. Mm-hmm. And I communicated that to the family, and I agreed with a lot of it, but obviously having a new winemaker coming on, I wanted to make sure that they had the tools, whoever it was, mm-hmm. to be their best, and for yeah. the brand to be their best. And so we ended up hiring Michael Scholes, and Michael had previously worked for us, created our style of Sauvignon Blanc, planted and overseen the planting of a lot of our vineyards that we're now producing, and he'd been gone for, I think, about 6 years. So it was actually wonderful to have Michael come back, and it was kind of funny that he was our best choice, having been here before, but also because he is creative, he's a talented winemaker, and I think he gets along well with everyone, and he wants to continuously improve this property. And Dollarhide, you know, our Dollarhide ranch is a little over 1530 acres, so a third of that now is planted, and a lot of it by Michael. And we wanted to look at that vineyard and continue to improve quality in the vineyard. And he knows the vineyard well, and it's not an easy vineyard. It's a high elevation vineyard. There's 13 different soil variations. There's a number of different varietals, and it's it requires an immense attention to detail.
Yeah.
And both our vineyard director and Michael have that attention to detail. So that was a big part of the selection process. But anyway, I sidetrack. So back to what we did, I communicated a lot back to the Scally family during this time frame. And so when Michael started in June of 2009, we immediately started investing in the cellar and making a number of changes. Some we got in place for the 2009 harvest. And by 2010, we were able to put in that whole new cellar of open top fermenters that I showed you when we were walking around earlier, and our hand sorting system, and really huge jump in quality we saw in 2010. Combination of what we were doing in the vineyard, vintage, Michael skill, and investment in the cellar. So very exciting for us. And, you know, we continued to invest in the cellar every year since. And in 2012, after we saw the results of what the hand sorting was doing, we added optical sorting to our Roundup. So all of our red wines are sorted down to the berry.
Wow.
And when you're picking up a $42 bottle of Napa Estate Cabernet, that's pretty amazing. And we reinstated our focus to be 100% estate grown, produced, and bottled.
Wow.
So some significant shifts.
Yes, no, right? Monumental. And you guys, when you come over, and notice I say when, because this property has to be seen, the cellar is absolutely a model cellar, highly functional, but looks so attractive, and you guys can actually see it, which is, I think, one of the most instructive things you can do when you visit a winery, is actually at least take a look at the production side of it. And I also made a mental note when you were talking about the hiring process. You said there are cult winemakers that you've had discussions with, and I know you've settled for very specific reasons on the winemaker that you felt was the best fit. So you had all the choices in the world, and he was the one. So just pay attention to things like that. And you also said $45 Napa cab. So I'm hearing quality price ratio. So let's talk about that. It sounds very consumer friendly. So how did you come up with a pricing structure? What drives it? What is the philosophy behind it?
So, I mean, the philosophy for our wines is to make the very best wine we can, every vintage. And, you know, like you asked me earlier, how do you shift a brand perception? And for us, it was, we're going to deliver the very best estate wine possible every vintage, and you have to keep doing that over and over, and you have to keep improving it over and over to get the attention of the gatekeepers, the distributors, the consumers. And so you can't just say, well, I'm going to charge, you know, $1 zillion for this product. You have to look at what are other people charging and competitively taste the wines blind and set a price point. We try to set a price point that's strategically below what our competitive set is, because I want to be a good value, and I want to be a wine that's real, and that's why we're 100% estate.
Wow. And that decision, again, to highlight the 100% estate, it's very labor intensive. You've described a vineyard that's absolutely gorgeous. There's a really large panoramic picture that just made me stop breathing for a second. It's very beautiful, but clearly intense. So having farming options that are, again, synergistic with your vision. Do you have your own dedicated crew?
So yes, we have a significant crew out at they're mainly at the Dollarhide Ranch. This estate is only about 54 acres here in Rutherford. So most of the crew's time is spent out at the ranch. And we have about 25 full-time people year-round. And then we have several farm labor contractors that we work with, which enables us to grow the number of people at the ranch for about 8 months out of the year. And those employees come back year after year. It's just during the downtime between the busy parts of the year, they go and work on someone else's ranch. But we have worked with most of these groups for a very long time, and we like them, and they do a good job.
So there's that level of symbiotic relationship between who tends to your vineyards, the winemaker, and who clearly is a vineyardist. He has to be. He's very dedicated to the viticultural aspect. I know you have quite an illustrious consultant named Michel Roland.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about that.
I love Michel Roland. He's just so wonderful. He came to work at Saint-Supery very early on. I want to say it was 1992, to work with Michael to create our red Bordeaux varietal blend, yeah. Elu. And so Michelle came on and worked with Michael then for many years in improving our red wine quality and mm-hmm. what we do in the vineyard and what we do at the winery. And so one of the things he left for a few years while Michael was gone as well. Mm-hmm. And we thought it would be great to have him come back.
Yeah.
And I think it's wonderful to have an outside perspective, particularly someone who has seen so much all over the world and all over the valley.
Yeah.
Right? He consults for a number of people in Napa Valley, and when he comes and sees us, he's seen, you know, what's working and what's not with different vintages, and he has great suggestions for us. When we were looking at the optical sorter, of course, he'd seen the optical sorters in many of his clients' wineries. Mm-hmm. He could say, well, this one breaks down more than that one. We've seen better results here. Mm-hmm. And so he's a walking encyclopedia. He's fabulous. And, you know, in addition, we have three sister wineries in Bordeaux, mm-hmm. and also share ideas back and forth with the team there. So that's really nice.
Wow. So I keep hearing what a blending genius he is, and obviously it's evidenced by the wines that I've tasted over the years, but you have a personal experience with sitting down with Michelle Arlan and tasting through a myriad of glasses. What is that like?
Well, I think that's more Michael's job than mine. I usually come in and say, are we making great wine, Michelle? And what can we do better? What do we need to invest in, and how can I help Michael and our vineyards be their very best? And so that's normally the conversation that I ask him every time he's here. And we do our very best to implement his suggestions and research them a little bit and see what's going to work for us and do trials. But we've implemented a lot of very cool techniques. We put in some concrete tanks the year before last, some small ones and some bigger ones last year.
Well, everything you're saying is kind of evidentiary proof of walking the walk, because as I'm thinking about such a labor-intensive vineyard and world-class expertise, those things cost money. And yet mm-hmm. I'm hearing a $45 price point, which I'm not
well, some are more expensive
out,
than that. But
you know, the fact that you even have a wine at that price point, mm-hmm. given the level of effort and expenditure.
We do often joke here at the winery that if everyone came and saw what goes into a bottle of wine, they would think no matter what they're paying is a fantastic deal. Because there's a tremendous amount of work in the vineyard, there's a tremendous amount of work in the cellar, and you know, just to do your very best. And we have an incredibly dedicated crew in the vineyard and in the winery. And Brooke, our other winemaker, and Asael, they do a fantastic job as well supporting Michael.
It sounds like a very cohesive team. And again, I just want to point to the fact that some naysayers prefer to talk about the price points and that Napa Valley wines are expensive, but there's a very good reason as to why a lot of price points, not all of them, but a lot of them are what they are. So I would encourage you guys to dig a little deeper and to find what the true story is and not just listen to the surface-like rumblings on the price points, because there's a lot more to that story, and you just heard a really important piece of it. And when you do come over and decide to learn for yourself, which I encourage very much, what type of hospitality experience would they find here?
You know, I think that we have a wonderful, energetic, very friendly, and very well-educated team in hospitality. I think they're very warm, and I appreciate that because, you know, we have people who are collectors who come. We have people, if this is their first time to a winery, who come, and I think they're very adept at making sure everyone has a great time and enjoys the wine and gets the most that they can get out of their visit.
The conclusion of this interview can be found in the next podcast, already available for your download. Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson.